It's hard to believe that Soundbites has been on the air for 30 years.
And nobody's been arrested yet.
Join Nick, Dave, and Steve every Saturday from noon till 2 on Jazz 90.1.
Jazz 90.1 is supported in part by our members.
Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 21st day of September, Anno Domini 2019, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news.
Da-da-da!
Da-da-da! Da-da-da-da-da! It's Shaw Brothers. Microsoft has a quality control problem right now.
I got that reference.
Thank you. One guy. I'll do a joke for one person, even if that person is me. Right now, Windows 10 updates are a minefield, with some updates causing more problems than they fix. And now, new warning suggests Microsoft's latest Windows 10 update might be one of the worst. Now, I know you think we...
Every month is the next one of the worst.
Yeah, really.
I think my watch is dead. Okay. I know you think we talked about this last week, but this is brand new. That was a different problem.
this is an additional problem
yeah.
to the other previous problems.
Yeah. The September KB4515384 update is already a menace, as we reported last week. Introduced to fix CPU spiking, reports state that it has broken Windows 10 search, the start menu, the action center, USB connections, and caused audio problems. And now it's gunning for your internet access.
But it fixed the spiking problem.
But
right?
it fixed the spiking problem. So, okay, we're good. Users are reporting on Microsoft's community forum, the Windows 10 feedback hub, and social networks that network adapters have stopped working after applying this update. Impacted users primarily appear to have Intel chipsets, Asus, MSI, and Gigabyte motherboards are mentioned, and both their Ethernet and Wi-Fi connections are affected. The cumulative update KB4515384 causes the NIC to fail to establish fail to enable with a code 10 error, warns one users on the Windows 10 feedback hub. Reinstalling network drivers from Intel or Windows update sources does not resolve the issue. However, removing the update through the programs and software panel or using a recovery point set before the update fully resolves the issue. So set a recovery point before you do the update. That KB also breaks Ethernet and Wi-Fi adapters on my PC, explained another user on the hub. Appears to create new devices as they are labeled number 2, and when exposing hidden devices in Device Manager, the previously named devices appear. Uninstalling the new or old drivers does not fix the issue. Only option was to uninstall the update. For its part, Microsoft has confirmed a new bug in Windows 10 1903 that can knock Wi-Fi on Intel and Broadcom wireless cards, but claims it's limited to NEC devices. So whether it's connected to this or on a whole nother new Wi-Fi issue remains to be seen. Needless to say, hopes will be high that Microsoft can issue a patch quickly again. But the bigger issue is whether you will trust that patch, given, as one user described it, Microsoft's GD garbage quality control. In the meantime, Microsoft continues to forcibly upgrade users to Windows 10 1903. So, look, I know you've got more to say on this. So if you go over to our website, soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, and scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, you will see the forums. The first forum is the show discussion, and currently the first item under that is 21 September 19, yet another update problem for Windows 10. So if you want to say something that will live for eternity, that's the place to do it. Also, if you prefer something more ephemeral, you can always give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
If you would all just erase your computers and start from scratch every time an update comes out, there would be no problems.
That's right. I don't know what your issue is. I don't know why you don't just do that. It's getting to be almost like a joke.
Chrome.
Well, yes. The reality is that 99%, well, 90% of everybody, let's say it's 80%. That's still a couple of hundred billion people. 80% of everybody could get along fine with just a Chromebook and do everything they need to do every day, and it wouldn't be an issue. A Chromebook would solve those problems. Going to Linux would solve those problems. Buying a Mac would solve those problems. But people continue to use Windows. It's, I get it. It's inertia. I get inertia. I do understand it. But if every time you have an update, there's an issue, at some point, you know, why do you hit yourself in the head with that hammer? Well, it feels so good when I stop. Okay, so stop.
I had an interesting customer this week. She had been a stay-at-home mom for 20 years, and now her kids are out, so she got a job. And she got a computer.
You mean another job? She had a job.
Didn't understand how to use the computer because the only thing she'd ever used is a tablet.
Right.
So it was the first time I had, you know, you shifted from a tablet to a computer, and it's radically different because there's no touch, there's no... you have to do everything with the cursor and the trackpad you touch. Okay, so the trackpad is like touching the screen, but then the cursor moves around like you would be touching the screen. And
right.
So it was interesting showing her things that we take for granted in the last 40 years
of
computers.
Spin. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Whole different spin.
And it's easier going from a desktop to a tablet than it is the other way around.
Yes.
You're already used to how things are working. And so you're used to a desktop and moving a cursor. So now on a tablet, your finger is the cursor and you
just point and you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very different thing. One of the things that fascinated me was a guy did a blog post this week. He thinks, and believe me, this is just one guy. He thinks Microsoft is going to replace the NT kernel. With Linux.
Ooh. Ooh.
Leaving the Windows GUI, which is the part everybody thinks is Windows, there and replace the underlying operating system with Linux. And in fact, it makes a bucket load of sense.
Yeah.
Because now 90% of the problems that the updates cause
are gone.
Go away.
Yeah.
And you still think you're using Windows, so you're
viruses,
happy.
Viruses, spyware, and everything else is
everything.
Going to take a whole different turn.
Everything goes away. And Microsoft they've joined the Linux consortium. They've created the Linux subsystem for Windows. They're doing a lot more stuff actively with people. They put out an entire YouTube series on learning Python. Now, they do it on a Windows machine on Visual Studio, but they say you don't have to use Visual Studio and you don't have to use Windows. If you want to use Linux or whatever, you can do that and blah, blah, blah. I've been learning Python because the Raspberry Pi programs well in Python, as a matter of fact. There are a lot of nice libraries for it, and I stumbled across that, and that was just sort of one more thing that said Microsoft isn't against Linux.
Well, especially if they can cut a lot of their, task force down in hunting down issues to, solve this problem and that problem before they can roll out any other new features.
But that would be a massive rewrite to rewrite Windows for a completely different kernel. Or would you start over again and build on top of the kernel? So that's going to be, the next version of Windows that becomes a subscription, so they can keep you paying for all the work they just had to do.
Right. Well, you see, the idea is, if you look at Linux, there are 40 or 50 or possibly 2,000 front ends, GUIs, graphical user interfaces you can put on top of the Linux kernel.
Yep.
And so the mechanism to attach a kernel to Linux is very well known. It is completely open source. So it is certainly not an impossibility for Microsoft to just take the GUI, write a layer that connects it to Linux, and you're done. Because they all run on Intel, so there's no change that way. You just need an interface layer between the kernel.
And like you say, most folks wouldn't know the difference anyways.
And then you sell it as Windows, and people don't know.
Most of folks.
Except that it runs faster and better and without bugs and without...
And the low-end PCs that people want to pay for because they're price conscious.
Right. Right. I've got an older, very inexpensive laptop that runs Linux faster than my wife's high-end Windows laptop with more RAM, better processor and everything. Mine just runs faster.
Cool.
And cleaner. And so it would be a boon. Now, before everybody starts getting crazy, this is one guy's blog speculating on this. But you know what?
It makes sense.
It makes sense. It would be...
The effort that they're putting forth right now to constantly do, fixes, and then it causes more problems, so they got to fix that, I mean, all this time that there has to be wasted correcting things that were done to correct other things,
And people have been wary about updates for a long time. Oh. And now they're getting even more so. And when the critical security update does come out, they're going to skip it.
Well, you've got another story that you're going to be reading again on Windows.
Same idea.
And it just, same thing. You know, that's why a lot of folks, their confidence in Windows is very very fastly.
Yep. There has not been an update to Windows this entire year that went well.
Yeah, it worked correctly.
It just the entire year, and you could go back to last September. Well, that's, so a full year, a full 12 months of bad updates for Microsoft.
Well, that's why I still have my Chromebook for the internet. My Windows 7 machine is not connected, and it runs my banking software.
Right.
That's the only thing I'm going to have it for.
Right.
Otherwise, everything else I do on the internet, emails, checking this, doing that, I can do on my Chromebook.
Right.
I create all my documents, everything else. It's just so much easier.
Yeah. And now the problem is if your update causes you to lose the internet, how do you download the drivers to fix it? Well, you have to roll back.
Yeah.
Which means you've got to do it within, 30 days?
Yep.
I think it is now. You only have 30 days you can roll back.
And it's a fairly arcane process to get into the diagnostic console and do that.
It's not easy like it used to be,
Right.
But
don't even know what key it is anymore. The F8 key stopped working.
I think it's Control F8.
Well, you have to do you can get into it when Windows is working with, Shift Shutdown or something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's another weird combination and playing around with it and getting it. Not like the old days with Windows 98 and 7 and that. You just hit the F8 key and bring you up the whole menu. How do you want to boot?
Right.
And that whole selection. That was one thing was stupid that they took away. Totally dumb because...
Look, you forget, it's not your operating system.
I know.
The real question is, if Microsoft does have a problem, if they put the Linux kernel underneath the Windows, is it worth the money they're going to charge just to have the Windows GUI?
Good question. Well, but the thing of it is, though, they're going to save money.
No question. That's not. But the point is, are you willing to spend however much it's going to be for what you could get mostly for free? If what's most important to you is the fact that there's a start button and the menu that you don't like anyway, and et cetera, then yeah, you're going to go with the kernel. With the you're going to pay the money and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And the problem is the vast majority of regular people just go to the store and buy a computer.
It's already preloaded.
Yeah, they don't care about any of this stuff. If you tell them that even now, you know, you buy Windows 10 and a lot of your Windows 7 programs may not work anymore, then they just don't bother getting a new computer.
That's right.
They'll keep using the old one.
That's mm-hmm. exactly right.
Oh, and then you see commercials, you know, from Microsoft about how great Windows is. They've got a new one out now from with a guy called Mackenzie Book.
Yeah, MacBook.
So they
call
how a MacBook considers the Surface. So they're comparing a desktop to a tablet. Okay, and this whoever this website is, it's kind of interesting about calling Microsoft out on all the crap. The kitchen he's in is not even a real kitchen. So why did you get a real person if that is his real name and
right.
put him in a set and all? But it's interesting that if you see the commercials, a lot of the commercials don't even tell what the features are anymore.
Right.
And even in the cell phone arena, the biggest feature is the phone. In fact,
biggest feature is the camera.
The camera, yeah, that's what I meant. The camera on the phone. There was a comment on one of the reviews of the new iPhone 11 about how great the camera is, and one of the comments was, "Well, what about the phone? Is it a phone? Well, what else can you make a phone do? We stopped caring about phones and phone calls 10 years ago.
Right, right.
Hardly anyone buys a phone to make phone calls anymore."
No, everybody's face down into the screen.
Yep.
You see them walking around like zombies with their face down into the screen.
See them walking into walls and walking into poles.
Oh, yeah, I see it all day long. It's
ridiculous. But at any rate, there you are. It's another issue with another update from Windows. So if you've already updated and you're fine, congratulations. If you've already updated and you had a problem, I'm sorry. We had a post from Hot Dog that said he had a problem. If you haven't updated yet, well, tick, tick, tick is all I have to say.
You got to hold off and wait till the next update and hope that fixes it. So hold off until the update after that. Maybe it'll fix. But then hold off until the update. Yeah. So that's and then suddenly there'll be some critical flaw that you won't get fixed.
Or I suppose you can just buy a nice little Linux machine.
Yeah. Then have your choice of GUIs.
And have your choice of GUIs. And you can find GUIs that work, that look almost identical to Windows. You can find GUIs that look almost identical, that do look identical to Macs. You can have whatever you want as your front end and still have all the benefits of a faster machine. With fewer update issues. I won't say Linux has no update issues.
A lot fewer.
I had one.
How long ago?
25 years, maybe?
I don't know. Those aren't strong statistics. Well,
even that last kernel bug that was found a couple weeks ago wasn't as widespread as, a billion Windows users?
Mm-hmm. In general, by the time I read about a problem in the Linux kernel, it's already been patched. I've already had an update.
Yep.
Generally, when I get an update, I go, okay, tomorrow I'll read about the problem. Fine.
And you almost never have to reboot.
I reboot maybe once every few weeks, maybe.
The last Safari update, I had to reboot after installing. Why? Because the browser is so tied to the kernel, it has to reboot. Okay.
Yep.
Chicken and tying, yeah.
And that just doesn't generally happen in Linux. And the other thing about Linux, of course, is one of the things that I have always railed against in Windows is the registry. Taking the most important part and putting it all in one file and making it so fragile, and then letting everybody and his brother and sister
into it
is, in fact, abysmally stupid.
Yeah, that should have had
plainly
strictly admin responsibilities, yep. And only after you put in a password twice to make sure.
But every single program that you use touches the registry.
Yep.
Whereas in Linux, all of the configuration files are separate.
Yeah.
So if you screw up your configuration, you didn't bother my configuration.
And the other big problem with Windows is all the shared DLLs. That you know, one program installs this file, another program tries to install a different version, and now the first program doesn't work right. So you fix the first program, and then the second program doesn't work right.
Right. All right, to the phones. Our first caller is David from Irondequoit, New York. Hiya, David. What's up?
Hi, Nick. Say hello to Elaine for me when you have a chance.
I will.
I went to, England for a couple of weeks. When I came back, cranked up the old mainframe here and discovered that my Gmail account, the main one that I used, it won't recognize the password that I've had for ages. And I've tried everything I can. What is unusual is that on my Android phone, on the iPad, on the Chromebook, I can get into it. It will find the newest Gmail for that account, not for my main computer here. So I was hoping you could direct me to the right menu or whatever.
Well, okay, Dave. I'm assuming you've got the right password, and I'm assuming you're typing it incorrectly, and I'm assuming you don't have the caps lock on, et cetera, right? The first thing I would do, because I actually had this problem at one point, when nobody else is around, open up a notepad and type in the password and see if all the keys are working.
Mm-hmm.
I had that issue with a key that stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would get no letter P, and sometimes I'd get two of them.
And it didn't look like that on the screen.
And of course, you can't see it because it's a password.
Yeah.
Well, because you have an asterisk. But
right.
Yeah. I went into Word to make sure I had my cap locks off, but because unfortunately on my keypad, there's no little green light or red light or whatever to say that it's either on or off. So. I did go into Word to check that out, but I'll check out the actual password as well.
All right, that's the first thing to check. The second thing to check is make sure that your Gmail has not been hijacked. So you need to dance the security tango and make sure that your machine is clean. And if it comes up with something, change your Gmail password immediately.
Is the error message password invalid or... What is the exact wording of the error message you're getting?
The exact wording is that a little, it will go in and try to find the emails for all the accounts. And then it will, a little box saying, I'm not on it right now. Invalid, change. Password or cancel, something like that.
I can't hear.
It's hard to know without the exact wording. I would try making a private window.
Which retry, enter new password or cancel.
Above that, it should give why it didn't accept the password.
It just says log into account failed. Log into server IMAP. googlemail.com with username failed.
Oh, this is not on the website. You're in an email program?
Yes, I'm in Thunderbird.
Okay, that's different. Hang on.
Okay, Dave, hang on. We got to take a quick break, but don't go away. We'll come back to you. So stay on the line. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and David. And a whole lot more sound bites on member supported Jazz 90.1 and streaming online at jazz901.org.
computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we've got David waiting patiently on the line from around Occoquan, New York. Still there, David?
Yep, still here.
Excellent. Okay, so you're actually getting that message from Thunderbird, then?
Right.
Right.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. But it's happening with your Gmail account only?
Yes, the one particular Gmail account.
Okay, the rest of them are fine. That one is not fine.
Right.
Okay. Now, because it's Gmail, you're using IMAP, correct?
Correct.
The easiest thing to do is to delete the account and add it again. Because since it's IMAP, all of the mail is still in your Gmail account at Google and will come back down again without losing any.
Oh, good.
We also found a suggestion to go into your Thunderbird password list and delete the saved passwords for that account just in case they got saved wrong. So a lot of times what happens...
Or corrupted.
Yeah, a lot of times what happens is you get that message, and so you type in the password you think it is, and you maybe mistype it, then it saves the wrong one. And then you type it right, and it saves the right one. So now there's the wrong one saved and the right one saved, and that confuses it.
Well, I did go into that password bit there, and it was fine, but I think you're right. I'll delete it and then redo it.
Right, delete the ones for that account. You don't have to delete all of them.
Right.
Right, yes. Just the ones for that account, and then have it. Try that first, of course. It's a lot easier than reinstituting the whole account, but try that first. So delete them, and then go check the mail and type in the correct password, and you should be fine.
Okay, great.
One thing I suggest is type the password into a notepad or whatever, and then copy and paste it into Thunderbird. That way you know you typed it correctly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes what I like saying is go to a web browser, make a new private window, and log in manually to make sure that you are typing the right password.
Right.
So it's not remembering anything, and it'll ask for you to type the password manually.
And like you said, to make sure that your keys are typing correctly.
Right, right, right. But give those things a try, David. See what happens.
Yeah, I'll do that. And hope for the best.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Have fun. Bye-bye.
It's always frustrating when you can't get your email.
Yep. And it is the number one thing. When I was a systems administrator... although I watched every one of my systems all the time, the one I really didn't have to watch was mail.
Yeah.
Because the instant mail was unavailable, I'd start getting 50 phone calls. Yep.
It's that catch-22, is that you love getting your email, but you hate getting all the spam.
Right.
So I dread looking at my email because 90% of it is spam.
That's a problem I have with my new phone.
Yeah.
Spam phone calls.
Yeah,
on the
worse.
Old phone, I had a whole bunch of numbers blocked, and now I'm having to reblock them all again.
And the bad guys.
But it's fun though having numbers. It, you know, on the menu when it comes in.
Yeah,
sit there and have it do the screening. I love it.
Yeah. All right, here's a. You can give us a call, by the way, 585-966 Jazz. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-04. 15. While you do that, I'll read the next news item. There's currently a major bug in Windows Defender, the free antivirus software that ships with Windows 10. Running a quick or full scan will fail after a few seconds and only go through a handful of files, resulting in incomplete, superficial results. Such scans are usually known to take tens of minutes and even hours. The issue has been widely reported over the past 2 days on the Microsoft tech support forums, on Reddit, and on tech support sites like Ask Woody, Desk Modder, Born City, and Bleeping Computer. The bug impacts Windows Defender version 4.18.1908.7 and later anything, which was, of course, released earlier this week. The bug was introduced while Microsoft fixed another bug, which it introduced with the July patch Tuesday. Per reports, the original bug broke SFC/scan now, a command part of the Windows System File Checker utility that lets Windows users scan and fix corrupted files. After the July patch Tuesday, this utility started flagging some of Windows Defender's internal modules as corrupted, resulting in incorrect error messages that fooled admins into believing there was something wrong with their Windows Defender installation and its updates. Microsoft announced the fix for the System File Checker bug in August, but the actual patch was delayed. When the fix arrived earlier this week, it didn't yield the expected results. Furthermore, the issue doesn't appear to impact Windows Defender only on Windows 10, but also on other Windows versions where Windows Defender ships, such as Windows 8 and 8.1. The same bug is reported with the Security Essentials, which is Windows Defender's precursor, on older versions like 7, Vista, and XP. Microsoft said that only manual or scheduled scans were impacted and that Windows Defender's real-time scanning protection was not impacted and should detect malware once it reaches the system. Fortunately, there is a way around this bug if users need to perform daily scans of sensitive systems. Instead of relying on a quick or a full scan, users can use the Windows Defender custom scan feature and select the drives or folders they like scanned manually, one by one. Or, of course, use a different antivirus program. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. If you can't trust your antivirus program, where are you?
I wonder if you can pick custom scan and then pick the whole hard drive. Because that's a custom scan then, right?
It is a custom scan. Good question. But I don't think you can. I don't know that. One of the many programs I don't use is Windows Defender. That's not true. I have a VM running Windows that uses Windows Defender, but it's never on long enough to actually go through it. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jerry from Webster, New York. Hiya, Jerry. What's up?
Hi. Good morning. Good afternoon, I should say.
Sure.
Are you able to answer a photo processing question?
Maybe.
Software?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I'm glad you said software because we don't have any darkroom people.
I shoot with DSLRs, but I also have a Panasonic Z80 fixed lens camera, which will shoot raw photos, and they use SilkyPix SE processing software to do raw. As you know, all the cameras have a different system. There's no one uniform one. SilkyPix is extremely difficult to use.
Sure.
I'm wondering if there's anything out there that would do those Panasonic RAW photos other than SilkyPix.
Do what with them?
Process RAW photos.
Well, the granddaddy of them all is Photoshop.
Photoshop, I don't believe, will do... Maybe you're right. Now, that's on a subscription basis now, right?
Yeah, it's $10 a month for the full Photoshop, or they have their Photoshop Deluxe, which is more geared for home users, which is a flat price, but that doesn't sound like you. Editing in RAW is. So Photoshop started out as a graphic conversion program that could read all sorts of formats and convert it to all sorts of other formats. I'm trying to find a list of what their RAW format supports, but it's possible. And I would also guess that Panasonic would have a Photoshop plugin for their own RAW format, because Photoshop is the granddaddy of all image editors. In fact, now Photoshopped is a verb,
right?
And people talk about their photos being Photoshopped all the time.
Well, you can get a converter for RAW in GIMP. You can use a program called AfterShot, although that's also a professional program and requires purchasing.
But everybody's RAW is slightly different. That's the problem.
Yeah.
What about Lightroom? Is that an Adobe product?
That's also an Adobe product. That's more of a light table where you would lay out all your photos and do some quick color corrections and pick the one you want to use for the magazine cover. So that's not exactly an image editor. That's more of an organizer.
I hear a lot of people using that, the professional be able to do portraiture and that type of thing.
Well, and Photoshop and Lightroom come together in that $10 a month subscription.
Oh, okay.
And I'm pretty sure they have like a 30-day trial you can download, too.
Yeah, good. I'll look into that. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yep, good luck.
Okay.
Yeah. So
a lot of professional editors like the RAW format because that's the RAW image that the camera took. Almost every camera these days manipulates the image before you even see it. In fact, that's the big thing on all the latest cameras is now the learning neural net, where it looks at your photos, it raises the contrast on some parts and lowers the contrast on other parts and adjusts the colors to give you the best looking photo, but it's not a quote unquote real photo anymore. So every picture you take has been manipulated by the camera. So there's actually been some interesting case law where someone claims a photo isn't real and you have to bring in a photo expert to say it wasn't manipulated, and then the other side has their experts to say it was manipulated. But all these photos are being manipulated by the camera before you even see them.
One way or the other.
One way or the other, yeah.
Yeah.
And even in RAW format, as we said, each camera has its own slightly different RAW format.
Right.
And that makes things trickier, too. And, you know, as we mentioned, Photoshopped is now a verb. That people are so used to Photoshop manipulating photos that that it's become the standard of just any photo manipulation, even though it may not have been done in Photoshop.
Right. I was just looking through my phone to see if you can save RAW photos on your Android phone.
Most cell phones don't save the RAW. They only save the JPEG. That's pretty good.
It's a Google.
Yeah. RAW is typically something in the high-end DSLR cameras. It's not something you often see in the lower-end point-and-shoot market because average people don't need to worry about or manipulate the RAW images.
But I can it saves both RAW and JPEG simultaneously as two separate images.
Yeah.
And it says uses additional storage, you think?
Yeah, RAW is a huge file because JPEG is compressed.
Right.
So you see your 12-megapixel camera would take a 12-megapixel image, 12 million pixels,
right?
Times 8 bits per color, times 3 colors per photo. So that's a lot of pixels. You open that JPEG file, and it's 3 megabytes.
Right.
The RAW file is probably 48 megabytes.
More. Yeah. It may not fit on many phones, actually.
Right, yep.
So, yeah, there's a that's an issue that people have always dealt with, size of photos. People want smaller photos because they take up less space, particularly when you're using them on the web. You don't need more than 72 dots per inch because that's all the
human
thing shows anyway.
Yeah.
The screen shows. And a 72 dot per inch picture downloads much faster. So your site is more responsive, which is always a good thing. But it's kind of a ridiculous issue to think I can either save my photo in something that is quick to view or in a massive file if I ever need to go to court, I guess is the way to put that. But they are two different formats. And if you're going to start saving RAW files, you may not have room on your camera. I know a lot. For a long time, iPhone didn't save RAW. I don't know if it does now. But it was mainly because, and neither did Android, because you just didn't have enough storage on the phone for one picture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different thing now. And when you have a camera that does RAW, like most professional photographers use, they've got gigabit storage devices, SD cards or whatever, because you can only store a few. You know, if you've got a thing that's 48 megapixels, you're not going to store a lot of that on your phone. You're not going to store a lot of that on any one medium of any sort. But if what you want to do is get the best quality picture, and then manipulate it yourself instead of letting the phone do it for you, then you want a RAW file and a product like Photoshop. A lot of people use GIMP. That's free, the graphic image manipulation program. But it is very different from Photoshop, and therefore you have to learn it all over again. And a lot of people certainly don't want to have to do that. But the reality is that the more you want to do, the more knowledge you have to have, and the more skill you have to have. And so people find that they've got a learning curve ahead of them when they want to really manipulate real raw photo images.
Yeah. And for average people, you just want to shoot a picture.
Yeah.
And so you let the camera do all the manipulation so it comes out with the best it can. And what we're seeing now is when you shoot, you know, a picture, in quotes, the camera's probably taking three or four and merging them all together with different effects to make sure that the brights are bright, the darks are dark, the middles are middle.
Middle, yeah. and when you take a photo, at least when I, on my Android phone, when I take a portrait, it actually takes two photos.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a standard photo where everything is in focus, and then it manipulates that photo to cut out everything from the background. And you can switch back and forth between them. It takes both. It saves both images.
Yep. Apple is on the new iPhone 11. They're coming out with a new feature later this year called Deep Fusion, where it's going to use all three cameras. It says it's going to take 9 images with each of the cameras and then calculate pixel by pixel the best of everything. And they say it's going to take about a second to give you a picture.
Yep.
Which is a very long time in the camera world.
Yes, it really is.
But that means you're not going to have to do all that manipulation yourself, and you're going to get a really, really good picture.
But it also means you better have a lot of space on your phone.
Well, then it probably
if you're one of those people who fills your phone, well, it's got to save those pictures while it's
temporarily. Yeah,
right.
So it'll need temp space. Yeah,
right. So, yeah, I get it. It's a long and involved process, and if you're a professional photographer, you're saving raw photos and manipulating them in something like Photoshop. But if you're just looking to take pictures, you know, particularly nowadays, there's a huge push to get massive photos on people's phones. But the reality is almost everyone these days only ever looks at the pictures on the phone, sends them to other people who only ever look at them on their phone. You don't need a high resolution photo to do that.
And we've seen most of the cell phones have either stopped talking about or stopped increasing the megapixel count. 12 to 16 megapixels is all most cameras, cell phone cameras are, because that's pretty much all the average person needs.
Right.
And so now having the wide-angle lens, the ultra-wide lens, the telephoto lens, you know, the different filter lenses, that's what we're seeing being added to cameras. And the processing chip to make the picture look better. You know, you take a 12-megapixel picture, you could blow it up to, wall size.
Right.
No one will. You're looking at it on your 8-inch phone.
And they're also talking about people making movies on iPhones now.
Yep.
But that's kind of a gimmick.
4K, 60 hertz.
Right. Yeah. But even so, you know, Steven Spielberg's not going to do it unless it's a gimmick.
Well, the people who started with an 8mm camera, Steven Spielberg, are now starting with their phones.
Right.
And moving into real production.
Right.
And that's a neat way to go. Then you get the 18-megapixel red camera for $150,000.
Right.
Was it Steven Jackson Peter Jackson. When they did The Hobbit in 3D, they had, I think it was it 10 3D rigs, and each rig had two red cameras on it, so they could do a stereo shot. And so now, when 8K TVs are popular, the Hobbit in 8K will be re-released. And then when 16K TVs are popular, the Hobbit in 16K will be released because he has all that data.
He's got it all. All right, we got a couple minutes to talk to Mark from Greece, New York. Hiya, Mark. What's up?
Hey, guys. Heard you talking about people having to learn new things. It's not as difficult as they would think because, you know, there's a great resource out there that most people are on all the time, and that's YouTube.
Yeah.
You can learn so much. I've learned so much. Like I told you a while back, I've been futzing around in my computers doing upgrades, which I was petrified of years ago.
Yep.
But watching some people do it on YouTube and watching repair people and kind of knowing what's beyond my scope and what's in my scope, you got to use some common sense. But there's a lot of information out there that you can find, especially for operating programs.
Right, right, right.
My brother bought Photoshop 5 years ago, and he learned everything he needed to learn on YouTube.
Yeah, and that's I've been learning Python. One of the things I've been going to constantly is the Socratica stuff on Python, and now Microsoft has one, and you can learn an amazing amount of stuff on YouTube. And what's nice about YouTube is you can go back and rewatch it and rewatch it and rewatch it.
And if you know how to teach something, you can make a living now on YouTube.
Well, you can also pause it. You know, that's another nice thing. As you're doing along, if you're writing down steps and all that, it's nice. Like you said, you can sit there and stop it, take some notes, have it keep going. And
right. Well, I had a sensor on my car that went, and I'm not a car person.
Right.
And I went on YouTube and looked it up and found where it was, and it really was literally one screw and one harness to get it out and to put it back in. It wasn't difficult at all. I had to take the little cover off the engine of my car. It's got this little cover that covers the engine, and that's just on these little push nipple things that they pop onto.
Sure.
I did that by myself, and I saved myself about $350.
Yep.
So, you know, there are some things you can't do. You don't have the tools, but if you look it up, you know, and sometimes you can rent the tools. So
yeah.
Exactly.
And one thing to keep.
There's a lot out there that you can learn just by, you know, going on the internet and getting on YouTube.
Yeah, but the key thing there, and I'm going to state this for anybody and everybody, is know your limitations.
That's it.
When it comes to electronics and everything else, some folks can make it look really easy, and it's like, yeah, no big deal.
Yep. But
stay within your limitations. If you're not comfortable working with electricity and that type of stuff or other things, stay away from it.
And be very wary that they may not have published the 10 takes where they broke something.
Yeah,
right.
And they only put the one that worked.
That's why I watch the ones that are step by step. And they tell you the warnings and they tell you, you know, exactly these things. And I watch quite a few videos before I decide which one I'm going to follow.
Yeah.
And like I said, I know my limitations and what kind of freaks me out that I won't touch.
Good for you.
Yep.
All right, we got to take a break. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Thanks.
All right, that's it. We're going to take a break. You've wasted an hour of your life with this nonsense, but don't go away. We'll be back with a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbites. We're going to have Dave Enright. We're going to have Steve Ray. You're going to be stuck with Nick Francesco. And, of course, all of you, give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Of course, you can join us on the web. You can join us on the YouTube there. And we'll be back with a whole lot more Soundbites. And the truly great and truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member supported. Jazz 90.1 right here and on Facebook. See you in a couple of minutes.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites.
Still.
Whether you like it or not.
30 years and going.
Unbelievable. 30 of the best. No, just 30 years.
Yeah.
30 lousy years.
30 lousy years.
Well, like I say, it lasted longer than my first marriage.
Yeah. Okay. The bad news just keeps on keeping on. If you've noticed an uptick in spam that addresses you by name, or quotes real emails you've sent or received in the past, you can probably blame Emotet. It's one of the world's most costly... Yeah.
Emotet.
Right. One of the world's most costly and destructive botnets, and it just returned from a four-month hiatus. Welcome back, Emotet. Spam sent by Emotet often appears to come from a person the target has corresponded with in the past and quotes the bodies of previous email threads the two have participated in. Emotet gets this information by raiding the contact lists and email inboxes of infected computers. The botnet then sends a follow-up email to one or more of the same participants and quotes the body of the previous email. It then adds a malicious attachment. The result? Malicious messages that are hard for both humans and spam filters to detect. A separate post from Malwarebytes says Emotet has brought back another tactic it first introduced in April, referring to targets by name in subject lines. Once opened, the documents attached to the emails claim that effective September 20th, 2019, that's yesterday, for those of you not paying attention, users can only read the contents after they have agreed to a licensing agreement from Microsoft Word. And to do that, users must click on an Enable Content button that turns on macros in Word. After the macros are enabled, Emotet executables are downloaded. When run, these executables look for other computers on the network and infect them. One of the ways Emotet spreads to other devices on the same network is by exploiting easily guessed passwords. With its massive pool of stolen emails and email server passwords, professional-grade malware, and sleek social engineering tricks, Emotet has rightfully come to be regarded as one of the world's most threatening botnets, at least for people using Windows. People should counter the threat by considering the use of Malwarebytes or other reputable anti-malware programs. Another measure, also antivirus software. You need both. Another measure, being highly suspicious of every attachment or link received by email, even when it appears to come from someone you know. People should also use strong passwords for every connected device in their network to prevent Emotet infections from spreading inside a local network. Malwarebytes has indicators of compromise in a blog post that you can use to determine if you've been targeted by Emotet. And Steve will put that up in just a few minutes. So have you been hit by Emotet? Do you even know? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415.
And when it gets in, one of the things it does is start looking for your bank account information.
Yep.
And it wants to steal all your money.
It wants everything it can get its hands on. Once it's in your machine, once it's got the privileges that it needs to get at stuff, it's going to grab everything it can grab. It starts with grabbing the email addresses and messages that you've sent to other people so that it can easily pass itself on to them. But then it goes after bank accounts and it goes after any kind of private data you may have. It takes pictures, it takes whatever it can get its hands on. And it's pretty virulent and it's pretty widespread, and it's getting wider spread at this point.
And it's another example of the social engineering and sophistication that's happening on threats, doing more and more to try to trick you into believing the threat because it's reading your old email, and because people don't realize that email is not very secure.
Right.
And there's similar ones going around that look at the breaches. We've talked about different companies getting breached and passwords getting exposed. And the malicious email will say, you know, I know your password, and if you don't pay me the money, I'm going to, you know, change all your accounts. And they give you your real password.
Yes.
That was lost on some other breach.
Right. There's a site called Pwn2Own, and it talks about billions, literally many billions of passwords that have been compromised. So it knows that you had that password at one point. And Pwn2Own just doesn't know the passwords. It knows the accounts they're linked to. So they just have to grab that database, which is easy enough to do, or grab the data from the same places that Pwn2Own grabbed it, and then send you an email saying, hey, I know your password. Here it is. And if you haven't changed that password, which you probably haven't, you can be tricked into thinking that you've been... that they know everything about you. And so you'll do whatever they say to do. It's happening a lot. We're seeing a lot of people caught by things like this. Don't be fooled. Be very careful. Anytime you are asked to type in your password or to authenticate something or to run something you normally wouldn't run, be very careful. Be very wary. If it's a website, check the real address. You can generally tell a lot about a site by clicking on the lock next to the URL. That'll tell you if it's a valid certificate, and you can then go down to site settings and see what those sites hold and the sort of permissions they're asking for and everything else. And you should do that pretty regularly.
And you may want to go to Have I Been Pwned yourself and sign up for their notification service. So if your email shows up in a breach, you get warned by them, because heaven forbid you're not going to get warned by the other end.
No. So you can do that. That's a free service. And these days you really have to pay more attention. You are, whether you like it or not, you are a systems administrator for your systems. And I know you're not trained to be one, and I know you don't think like one, but you have to be one, whether you like it or not. And even then, it doesn't mean you can't get hit. It just means it's less likely.
I like how some of the latest breaches are bad guys breaking into other bad guys.
Yeah.
No honor among thieves. So that, 770 million addresses and email accounts and passwords were lost in something called Collection Number One, which a bad guy collected billions of other breaches and found 700 million new ones.
Right. Right. And those are new ones, not that there are like 8 billion of them, 8.5 billion, I think it is.
Yep.
Somewhere in there. And believe me, 8.5 billion, you're in there. Don't even pretend you're not. You are in there. And if you are and you haven't changed your password, you are vulnerable. So you should. Oh, I'm
owned. Been pwned.
I've been pwned. I've done all of that. I've changed all those passwords. It's kind of ridiculous.
Especially if you've had your same email address for a while, more than a year,
right?
Then you've probably been pwned.
I've got
back
email
in time.
Addresses that are specialized for certain websites that I run. You know, the no replies and all of that stuff. They've been pwned.
Yep.
You know, you got to be more wary than you are.
And never,
it's that simple.
And never use the same password on more than one site, because when one site gets breached and that password is lost, the first thing the bad guys do is try that password on every other site.
Right.
Like Amazon and PayPal and eBay, things that have money on them.
Right. And you might, and I know. Oh, I can never think of a new password. It's such a pain. Oh, my God, I can't do it. That's why you use a program like LastPass or EndPass or any sort of password manager. They can recommend passwords for you and save them and then copy them to the clipboard so you can paste them into sites when you use them. Think about that. That's the easiest way to do this stuff.
I was in a store a while ago, and they had to buy a new loose leaf notebook, and they had basically a blank notebook sitting there that you could write whatever you want in. It was like $4, and then they had one that said passwords on the cover. That was $5. So yeah, it costs more to have a book that says passwords on it.
Right.
But write your passwords down, and then keep that book safe. Date. Put a date and time when you make a password, so then a year from now when you're trying to find your password, you know it's this one, not that one. When you change your password, you got to remember to go back and delete the old one. That's why a password program is a lot easier than trying to use a paper book.
If you can find a telephone notebook, the ones that with the letters, down the side, those are even better, because then you can separate things out by site. So your Google password goes under G, and your Yahoo password goes under Y, and you can find them easier. And Steve is right. If you're going to use paper, date everything. I use EnPass, and EnPass, you know, I can change stuff as I go. I can take notes to myself. So, you know, I remember that I called my first dog, you know, the secure. Oh, yep. And when you type in a security code thing, those security questions, lie. You know, what was the name of your first dog? Table.
Here, Table. Come here, Table.
Here, Table.
Fred, get off Table.
Yeah, right.
We'll go. How many times do we have to tell our cats to get off the darn table every day?
Like they listen.
Yeah.
But that, so lie, you know, what well, was your mother's maiden name? Purple.
Well, wait a minute. People have trouble.
You can't remember the real one.
Right.
People have trouble just remembering the passwords besides remembering other unique. I agree that's with you 100%. Why? I do.
Yep.
On every one
but
of them.
That's why if you use something like EnPass or LastPass or one of those password managers, they have a notes field. And in the notes field, you type the security question and your fake answer.
Yeah.
So that they are kept secure. You can go to them anytime you want to.
What it boils down to is taking the time.
Yep. Right.
And once you do it once, it's already, once you build it up in those systems to remember your passwords, you're done, folks. It will remember it for you. No more thinking and what was that one of those? No, it'll just do it for you. So, you know, it can make your life a lot easier down the road. Maybe not right up front, putting in all these different passwords for all these different things. You know, this pain in the butt. Yeah. But you know what? How important is your security and keeping your information safe?
We have a lot of older customers where this is especially hard on, and so we're going through security reset procedures. And who was your best friend in high school? That was 60 years ago. I don't remember.
Yeah, right.
Lie.
Yeah.
Who was your oldest friend in high school? Kleenex.
So
registered trademarks.
You're not going to remember who your friend actually was, so how are you going to remember how you lied?
Right. That's why you write it down. That's why you keep something like I said, EnPass. I have EnPass on my phone, on my desktop, on my laptop, on my tablet, on my, it's everywhere. So you can, you know, once you've written it, it duplicates everywhere else. So you only need to keep track of it in one place and it will show up everywhere else. When I save something on my phone, it shows up on my desktop, vice versa. And these are the things that you have to, just take that extra moment. Steve is right. It's, you know, instant gratification is no longer fast enough. But we need to take a moment every once in a while to make sure that we stay safe. And you do it once and you do it right the first time, you don't ever have to do it again. Maybe you change the password once in a while, but it's already in there. It's already set up. You've got your security questions and answers. Change them every once in a while. Don't use the same questions or answers and the same on different websites. Yeah, change those up as well. I was at a website the other day that required me to actually write in my own security question.
Mm-hmm.
So I generated a 64-character password, used that as my question, generated another one, and used that as my answer.
I like the ones that make you do math.
Yeah. That's hard enough for everybody. I was on a site the other day that I signed up for it, and it didn't like my password. Because it was too long.
Yeah.
Huh?
I've seen
it. Yeah, it came back and said, password must be between 8 and 24 characters. What? You're limiting me?
Yeah.
That's just bad programming. Sorry.
I remember there was an episode of Security Now where they were looking at bank and other website practices for passwords. And they found a company that allowed a 2-character password. They checked for 1 character. So if 1 character wasn't enough, but 2 was okay. Really?
And all you have to do is put in less than, say, 8.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day when I worked in the bank, passwords were 6 or 8 characters and that was it. You were done. They were all Fortran and COBOL code anyway. Yeah. So, you know, your maximum character length was 8. You're done.
But then I read another story about someone who was mad because I can only remember 2 or 3 characters. Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse. What am I supposed to use? I can't put in eight characters.
Happy, grumpy, sleepy, sneezy, dopey, doc, and bashful. There's seven right there.
Well, I need
Snow
eight, darn
White.
It.
So now you got eight.
Yeah. And that password would probably be too long because it's too many. There's too many letters in your characters.
Right. yeah, we joke because we're frustrated. You should always use long involved passwords. And again, your password manager can suggest passwords. It can generate passwords for you so you don't have to remember. In fact, you never even have to look at it. Generate it, say okay, copy it. There's usually a copy button in the password manager. Paste it into the site, you're done. It's actually easier to use a password manager than it is to make up passwords yourself.
Yep. And there are a lot of people trying to develop a way better than passwords because they know people can't remember it. So we've, Steve Gibson on GRC working on the squirrel using QR codes. They're biometric. You know, we've got fingerprints and Face ID. How well can biometrics be spoofed? Like you see in the movies where you cut the guy's finger off and it still works on the pad.
Right.
And so, you know, trying to find something other than a password. In fact, the guy that created passwords apologized a couple years ago.
Yes, he did.
I'm sorry. We didn't know any better. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
It was the right idea at the time. Yeah. There was no other way to do that. But there are lots of other ways now. People are trying to figure out how to use your phone. Right now we have two-factor authentication, which is certainly better than one-factor authentication. Right. Although it's not great, it's better.
And the problem can be that for most places that second factor is a text message to your phone, which can be easily spoofed.
Right.
So that isn't really a good. You need to use a Google Authenticator, YubiKey token. Apple uses their messaging platform, so it comes as a message, not a text.
Right.
So it's direct device-to-device, so it's a little more secure. And even companies that offer two-factor, most of them will have a fallback. So you don't have your phone with you? Oh, okay, enter your security question.
Right.
That you just gave on a Facebook quiz about your best Game of Thrones.
Well, and that's the other thing. Stop doing Facebook quizzes, for Pete's sake. Stop doing Facebook quizzes. All they're doing is collecting your personal information. Your elf name is the first dog you had and your third grade teacher's last name. Guess what? Those are security questions. Every single one of the questions and every single one of those stupid quizzes you take is in fact a security question, and they're just gathering that information. They already know who you are because you're on Facebook, and they have your email address. Because Facebook has lost everybody's email address at least twice. Yep.
Well, then they just recently got someone found out Facebook was taking phone numbers for two-factor. And it turns out they were using those phone numbers in marketing and advertising.
Yes.
Contrary to what they said they were going to do.
Yes.
This is just for two-factor. We swear. Fingers crossed behind our back.
Yeah, don't believe Facebook ever, about anything, ever. It's just, it's ridiculous. So be aware. You have to be aware out there. I know it's a pain in the neck. And what you really want to do is just sit there and scroll around on the internet and take quizzes on Facebook. But that stuff is dangerous. The world is a dangerous place. Get over it. Deal with it.
It used to be easier when the bad guys hid in dark alleys and jumped out at you. But now the bad guys are in your house, you know, in your hand, you know, tricking you into doing something without you realizing it.
Right. I have a Far Side calendar.
That's coming back.
Yeah, as far as I
know. Farside's coming back.
May be coming back.
Did you see the
I saw the thing.
The logo they
I
had.
I saw it. Said they may be coming back. But anyway, I saw a Farside calendar of a guy being robbed in an alley, and I thought, it's not how it happens anymore.
Yeah.
It's really rare. It's much rarer than. Yeah, I saw that. Now if we could just bring back Calvin and Hobbes, I'd be a happy man.
How about the Far Calvin and Hobbes side?
The
Throw in a little Gahan Wilson, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Did you know that there's a strip called Pearls Before Swine?
Mm-hmm.
And several years ago, the guy who writes it, Bill Watterson, who did Calvin and Hobbes, just quit, just went away, complete hermit, doesn't talk about it, doesn't do anything. But this guy got his email address from somebody and wrote to him and said, would you like to collaborate on a strip? And he said yes. Only they didn't tell anybody.
Wow.
They just did the strips and people were going, who's this new artist?
Mm-hmm.
Who's this guy? This is a different guy. And it wasn't until well after it had aired that he said, I'm Bill Watterson. Yeah, very cool stuff.
The grind that just comes into doing 7 cartoons a week is something.
I cannot imagine.
This Week in Tech, they just did an interview with Randall Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
XKCD. And he's a lot younger than I expected.
Yeah, he's a kid.
I should have known because he's a geek.
Yeah.
But that was good. If you haven't seen it, I'm going to post a link to it. If you like XKCD. He had a really interesting...
How do you not like XKCD?
He had an interesting story about where XKCD came from and how he made up the name because he didn't want it associated with any brand.
Right.
And now that's the brand.
That is the brand. Yeah. Well, it's like Kodak was just a word that nobody had ever heard before. Xerox.
Yep, and it doesn't translate into any language, so that it's the same word in every other language.
Right. So yeah, it's a pretty cool thing, and I'm frankly looking forward to the Far Side returning. We need a little more humor these days, and
Randall Monroe's new book is the audio version is by Will Wheaton. So I almost want to buy it twice. So it's how to absurd scientific advice for common real world problems.
Yep. Some pretty good stuff. So listen, be aware of your passwords, be aware of the fact that they've been caught, and deal with it correctly for a change. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco. And you, give us a call, 585-966-5299, 1-800-790-0415. It's 29 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1 online, on YouTube, on your brain all the time.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1, turn your radio down. 2, turn your radio down lower. 3, remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4, make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5, calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6, if you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7, is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Join me for the best in vintage and contemporary jazz every Thursday night from 6 to 8 o'clock on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Contemporary jazz with polka background music.
Yeah. That's Rob's Rob Linton sense of humor. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I say humor. It was the politer word, and this is radio.
Maybe polka is the contemporary jazz.
We'll ask Tomasa about that.
Welcome back with just Dave Enright and Nick Francesco.
No, Ray and Al are gone. They're not waiting out there to jump me.
You hope.
Yeah.
Well, here's a great one for those of you who have webcams or DVRs or pretty much any device that connects to the internet and the Internet of Things, the IoT as they call it. Hackers have found a new way to amplify the crippling effects of distributed denial of service or DDoS techniques by abusing an improperly implemented tool found in almost 1 million network-connected cameras, DVRs, and other Internet of Things devices. The technique abuses WS Discovery, or WSD, a protocol that a wide array of network devices uses to automatically connect to one another. The protocol lets devices send user datagram protocol packets that describe the device's capabilities and requirements to ports to other machines over port 3702. Devices that receive the probes can respond with replies that can be tens to hundreds of times bigger. WSD is shipped with Windows since Vista and is one of the ways that operating systems automatically find network-based printers. So, yes, you're using this on your network. The WSD specification calls for probes and responses to be restricted to local networks, which theoretically makes them safe. But over the past few months, researchers and attackers have started to realize that many Internet of Things devices allow devices to send probes and responses over the Internet at large. The result, these improperly designed devices have become a vehicle capable of converting modest amounts of malicious bandwidth into crippling torrents that take down websites. Depending on the device, responses can be anywhere from 7 to 153 times bigger, an amplification that puts WSD among the most powerful techniques for amplifying distributed denial-of-service attacks. Researchers with content delivery network Akamai were recently in the process of investigating WSD amplification when a customer in the gaming industry was hit with just such an attack. At its peak, it generated 35 gigabytes per second of junk traffic. That's nowhere close to the record-setting attacks of 620 gigabytes in 2016 and 1.7 terabytes last year. Still, the new amplification method is concerning in part because the pool of available devices, which Akamai estimates is more than 802,000, is so large. It's going to be pretty bad, especially once the bad guys figure it out, Akamai researcher Chad Seaman told us. It's bad enough that, told us in a web post, why did I say that? It's bad enough that most people should be concerned about being hit with it. So what can you do about it? Well, nothing. You have no access to update most IoT devices, and home routers don't have the power or smarts to handle DDoS attacks. We'll have to wait for manufacturers to update their IoT devices, assuming they can. So how many dedicated devices do you have that connect to the Internet? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
So now you have to worry about upgrading your DVR, upgrading your thermostat, upgrading your webcam. And yes, you do.
Yes, you do. And the problem is many of these things were never designed to be upgraded. Right. The reason they're so cheap is because they're just locked in. And they have no way to be updated. So you have one of two choices. You can either just sit there and let the thing be owned by somebody, or you can replace it with a device that can't be owned. And that's assuming you can find one that isn't. So if you've got anything that connects to the Internet and makes itself known to the Internet. People have toothbrushes that connect to the Internet, for Pete's sake, and those are vulnerable.
I keep saying I want to buy one of these. So there's a Wyze Cam. Wyze is an old name, but they've been around forever.
Sure.
$25 for an HD security camera. And they do it right. It's got good security. It's got update mechanisms, and it's only $25.
I've been looking at the same one.
Yeah.
And you can stick a card in it, or you can connect it to the Internet. You can do whatever you want to do with it. It has audio.
Yep.
So if you wanted to stick it outside and make it your Ring a doorbell kind of thing, you can do any or all of that with it. And
who's that by?
Wyze, W-Y-S-E, $25. $25, and it does everything you need it to do.
Yeah, I was just looking at another one here. Same type of thing, you know. You can put a card in it.
You put a card in it for recording, or it's got an app that you can record with.
Yep.
And it's one of the higher-rated ones, and they do the security right.
Yeah, but you got to be careful of what you get and where you get it. Wyze is a well-known name. They've been doing computery stuff in various forms for decades, and they make a pretty nifty little product. So, and for $25, it's hard to go wrong. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Bob from Irondequoit, New York. Hiya, Bob. What's up?
Hi, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The you had a gentleman say that, you know, you can just about learn anything from YouTube, and he's pretty much right. My question is, over the different software, such as like Excel or LibreOffice, Calc, any of those, sure, is there any one programming language that will work over all of them?
No.
I said programming language kind of go in cycles. When I was in school, it was Pascal and right. Fortran and COBOL.
But you're old.
Yeah.
When I was in school, well,
they didn't have computers when you were in school.
We had stone tablets and chisels. Shut up.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. In general. There's a thing called Visual Basic for Applications, VBA, that works with the Microsoft Office stuff. The LibreOffice software will read almost all of VBA and use it. So that certainly works between those two.
Okay.
I don't honestly know.
There's kind of a growing popularity in scripting languages. JavaScript was probably one of the granddaddies, but they gave it too much power, and so now that's being abused. But scripting languages, PHP and Perl and Ruby and a bunch of them that are new and up and coming. In college, I took a class on the future of programming language, and C++ was one of the future programming languages.
Yeah.
And we're way beyond that now.
The hottest programming language now is Python, believe it or not. But at any rate, if you're going to use Google Sheets, you can do JavaScript. But there's no one that I know of. There's no one thing that does it all. Excel macros will work in Google Sheets.
That's good to know.
But, hold on. They have to be kind of retranslated to Google Apps script, which is essentially JavaScript. You can't run them directly, but translating them is pretty easy. Most of the commands are the same. There's just a few little things you have to watch out for. You can't use most scripting languages with Excel or Google Sheets or LibreCalc.
They have their own scripting languages built in.
Right. So you really need to be aware of the fact that other than VBA being sort of cross-compatible with LibreOffice, nothing.
Okay, because I was looking more to use Google Sheets, the project that I'm doing. I want it more up in the cloud so can access it from just about anywhere.
Yeah, depending on what it is you're doing, you can fairly easily convert whatever you need from VBA into the JavaScript based language that's built into Google Apps. But the other thing you might want to look at is there's a vast array of plugins, including macro plugins for Google Sheets, and somebody may have already done what it is you want to do.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. I'm just trying to create a real small database to track attendance is what I'm trying to do.
Right. Oh, I would definitely look for that. Teachers have been using Google apps, the Google Docs sheet stuff for a very long time. And I'll guarantee you somebody's written something you can use.
Right. It's basically just writing a couple of buttons to transfer the information from one sheet to another. That's what I'm trying to do.
Right. Yeah, take a look around, see what you can find.
Okay, thank you for the information.
All right, good luck.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. And it may be that a formula will do what he wants to do. I mean, because a formula can reference another sheet.
Yep.
So you can say if there's an X in this one, count it as a 1 in this one, or whatever it is you're trying to do. And that works pretty well. I've been using...
I remember some of the massive 1-2-3 macros we had written. And then there's an error on character 147.
I told you once, this guy comes in when I was working at the bank, comes in, he's all angry with me. Like, I've never met this guy before, but he's angry with me. He says, I understand you're a an Excel genius when it comes to the macros. I said, no, but I know them. Why? And he takes this sheet of paper, and it was the folded paper, you know, from the dot matrix printers, and throws it on the table. And it was an 8-foot long table, and it fell off either side. That's how long this guy's macro was. And he says, well, there's a problem in here. Find it. As the paper settled to the table, my eyes lit on the fact that there was a semicolon missing after a print statement.
Yeah.
And before it even hit the table, as it was settling, because, you know, it's paper, it's paper. It takes a while. Settling down, he said, well, you missed the semicolon after the print. It's pretty obvious to me. I walked out of the room. He called me about 10 minutes later and said, how did you do that?
How else are you going to keep your reputation as a miracle worker?
You didn't tell him how long it really took, did you?
Yeah.
Then you just turn to him and say, there you go.
That's right.
Don't ever question me again.
I remember some of the COBOL programs we wrote that you made a mistake and the error printout was longer than your program.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
When the priest brings back with that giant pile of paper and, you know, oh, what did I do now?
Yeah, right.
That should have been a one-sheet answer, yeah.
I can remember back when I was going at RIT and taking assembler language.
Oh, my, yes.
And you'd sit there and do it all up on the cards and then turn them in, and then you get your report back.
Yeah.
And then you had to go through all of it.
I simply don't have the patience for assembler. I was doing assembler on my Raspberry Pi for a while. I just don't have the patience. I don't care.
I was so glad.
Python is much better.
Well, I was just so glad to get that course off, out of the way. That course couldn't go fast enough.
Yep.
But I got it done. I think it was like a B+ out of it. So I was happy.
That's all that counts.
Yeah, get the heck away from there. Go back to my Fortran and, you know, COBOL. I was doing PL1 at the time also. So, you know, that was all good.
That's all good.
I remember one teacher I had for a PL1 class. He'd just before the final exam, he worked out your grade and how many points you would need to get on the final to go to the next grade.
Right.
And for someone that needed like 2 points, he's all right, just put your name down.
Right.
Someone that needed, you know, 120 points, he said, yeah, go home.
Yeah, right. There's not much you can do to get to a C from your D.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. It's tough. And of course, I learned fourth.
Yep.
Which ruins you for every other language because it is so amazing. It really, learning any programming language helps you with any other programming language. So I was very happy to learn some of the techniques that fourth forces on you, which are good, you know, the proper way to do things.
Yeah, getting the structure down and the logical thinking. I've always thought that helps me in repairing computers because I know how they're supposed to work. And so when they don't, you've got that logical flow they're supposed to do.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mike from Henrietta, New York. Hiya, Mike. What's up?
Yeah, when you guys were talking about pictures earlier today and cameras, I just have a quick question. My old Samsung Android used to take, it was 5 inches. It used to take real nice pictures, you know, point shoot kind of a thing. Nice.
Right.
But the new one I got, this whizzy one that said sort of the top heavy 5.5. I don't know if you have any suggestions or not because I read and I read and I reread the directions. And you're supposed to touch where you want it and you'll see the cursor come out and focus on it. But then when you touch the white button, I do it, you know, you have to hold your breath with this one like you're doing brain surgery and touch it. And
yes.
It still sometimes comes out blurry. And I don't know if I'm doing something wrong or that's just the nature of these larger phones or not.
Well, no, it's not that. It's honestly you. most of them have a fairly sensitive thing. Are you on an Android phone?
Yeah, I got yes.
Okay, you might want to take a look through the settings. My phone has a thing that pays attention to motion. And if I'm shaking the phone, and I'm old, if I'm shaking the phone, it lets me know it's waiting for stillness.
No, I'll get a little snide little message, hold the phone steady.
Yeah.
And I am, you know, and sometimes there's a tip where you turn it on its side and you use the volume control as a shutter versus, you know, pushing on the glass. But I just this new one. I think maybe it's top heavy. Just to do that, maybe you have to just support it somehow. But as I said, my pictures on my old phones are perfect. You just sort of like point it and then just touch it and bang it.
Maybe too sensitive.
Right. If you're taking vertical pictures, which you should never do with a cell phone, you can grab most of the cell phone because that camera's right at the top.
Right.
Yeah. So you can hold that, and then
the horizontal is the best way to go.
Well, that's, yes, vertical pictures on a phone are an abomination in the face of the earth, unless you're taking a specifically vertical thing, like he does rocket photos. Those are vertical, okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then you see these YouTube videos, people took a picture, and they're panning the phone back and forth, trying to get two people in the picture. Turn it sideways, that's what it's for.
But either way, it's a lighter touch. You're saying that's the key to the whole thing.
Yeah,
and there's also a feature in a lot of new phones, bokeh, is it? However you pronounce it, where you can focus on the front and focus on the back in the same picture. So it lets you change the focus after you've taken the picture, that's often a feature on the newer smartphones.
Oh, I'll be darned. Maybe I got to keep reading the book.
Yeah.
Okay, I just, you were talking about that earlier, and I thought, gee, maybe I'm doing something wrong. Everybody was talking about pictures with Photoshop, et cetera, which I guess is kind of nice. You can kind of tweak the flesh tones a little bit and, make it a little bit clearer. If you got a picture sometimes inside, it doesn't, it makes them look bland, and then you tweak with put some blood in your face, so they look real. But that's neat. Hey, I'll give that a shot with the landscape. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Sure. Taking a picture with a cell phone is easy, but it also isn't that easy. You do have to hold the phone steady. You do have to be aware of what you're doing. And most phones don't give you a lot of area to hold the phone on.
In the traditional cameras, you'd hold it up to your face and you could steady the phone.
Yourself a tripod.
And you steady it against your face while you're looking through the viewfinder. Right.
Now you're holding it out at arm's length and it jiggles and it's not...
I got to remember to take my little tripod with me when I go places so I can shoot better photos. I got a tripod here for the webcam, but it's a regular tripod mount. I put my real camera on it when I need to do something steady.
There are companies that make cell phone gimbals. Which are essentially stabilizers. So you attach your phone to it and you hold on to a single handle at the bottom. And even if you move your hand, the phone stays steady. Those aren't tremendously cheap, mostly. But they do work. And there's one for $175. Okay, maybe not that one.
That's the cheap one.
Yeah.
DJI Osmo is a very popular one. That's $200.
Yeah, that's the one I was looking at. $177 Amazon, apparently, the one I was looking at. But they do make one for
$7,000. It's a whole rig.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah. So in the motion picture industry, oftentimes it's a Steadicam, which is a giant rig that the person wears to hold the camera on it. So when the person is running down the street or the hall following the action, the camera doesn't jiggle.
Right. These are little handheld gimbals, but they work much the same way. All right. That's it. We're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. We appreciate it. It's been 30 plus years, and it's all on you folks. You're the ones who keep this show on the air. I want to thank Dave Enright. I will thank Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco, and we will be... back here next week. Pay attention to where you go on the internet and what you do, and make sure you stay safe out there, will you? We'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you that we are member supported. Jazz 90.1 on air, on mobile, on pretty much everything you can name. We will see you in 166 hours.